R. W. Timbrell, T-I-M-B-R-E-L-L, in Ottawa on the 5th of June, 1982. Thank you for inviting me over to your lovely place this afternoon, Bob. We've talked about where we would start, and so you please will tell me about when you joined the Navy and why.
Well, hell, we go back to West Vancouver, 1935, when money was a bit tight. My stepfather was out of work, and in came to Vancouver those days, the White Empresses, the Empress of Canada, the Empress of Japan. And up the street from us lived one Ronnie Jackson, later Commander Jackson, Captain Jackson, who was running our West Vancouver ferries. And through Ronnie's advice and influence and the desire eventually to be on the bridge of one of those Empress ships, and the fact that because I'd been born in England, my father was English, and we'd returned to England at the end of World War I, there had been some money left to the family which I could use in England only for my education. And through those procedures and factors, I proceeded to join the HMS Conway, a cadet training ship located in Liverpool, United Kingdom. Arrived there September 1935.
Age?
15 years of age, with still the objective in mind to be on the bridge of a Canadian Pacific ship, namely the Merchant Service. 1 year passed. It was a very interesting year for a raw Canadian to go over and join the English school system, which you know well, put up with. Instead of the cane, we had a teaser, so anytime you didn't move quickly enough or sweep the deck properly or lash your hammock up in the 1 minute and 32 seconds, you got a stroke across your bottom up to a maximum of 12. I recall that was not as difficult to live with as at the end of it, to stand up at attention and look at this young English squirt and shove your hand out and say, "Thank you, sir. That really hurt."
Another cadet?
Another cadet.
A senior cadet, yeah.
And an English squirt, and I'd never forgotten that term. But later, of course, when one became a cadet captain, one saw the pleasures of life coming back. 1 year went by. Survived. I can't really say it was the finest, most enjoyable chapter in my life. I often used to analyze that somehow I was a late starter in life. I enjoyed life more than I seemed to apply to it, and it wasn't until I reached the rank of Rear Admiral I realized that there was a career in it for me. So one considers a late starter. Nevertheless, back to Conway. 1 year there, then suddenly my parents heard that the Canadian Navy had opened the gates to recruiting. And through friends of my mother's here in Ottawa, I got the message to report down to Portsmouth, which ended up being interviewed by then one Commander Leonard Murray, Royal Canadian Navy, who was commander of the Iron Duke. And we had a delightful lunch. I had a tour of the Iron Duke, taken back to the railway station, and later to be advised I was accepted for the Royal Canadian Navy, which still meant completing certain other things such as medicals, which I did in London at Admiralty.
Either you said it and I missed it. What year is this?
1936.
36, and Len Murray, later Admiral Len Murray, was what of the Iron Duke?
The commander.
He was the
executive officer.
All right, thank you.
And so I go back to Conway for my second year, it's a two-year course, and I enter the naval class to join the Royal Canadian Navy in August 1937 with nine other cadets. My term was a large term, the 1937 term. There were 10 of us. There was O'Brien, Frewer, McDowell, Porter, who was later killed in the St. Croix.
Well, what's his first name?
Tim Porter.
Tim, yeah.
From Vancouver Island. There was Freddie Frewer, There is Savard, Paul Clement Savard from Quebec.
Yeah.
Dudley Alcock, paymaster. Peter Cassette, paymaster. And another paymaster called Eden, E-D-E-N, who was killed at the Battle of River Plate, and of course myself, all 10 of us.
Yeah.
We joined Erebus September 1937.
After your second year at Conway was finished.
Right.
Yeah.
And the 10 of us joined along with a large group of English cadets called Public School Entry.
Yes.
As the Dartmouth cadets went straight to another ship which we later joined. And there, one met the CO of the Erebus, Commander Fanshawe, Royal Navy. Fanshawe was unique. He had no liking for anyone from then the colonies or the Commonwealth. And one morning, we were all lined up in the corner deck, and he advised us that he had written a letter to their lordships recommending that we all be fired from the Navy as being unsuitable officer-like material. My mother in West Vancouver, many miles to the west, received a copy of that letter and, of course, was rather intrigued by the term and rather queried as to what their term the lordship applied to. Did one look up to the heavens or not? Because she certainly had no knowledge. Nevertheless, she was worried that her young son was going to be returned shortly with a kit bag and rather new clothing, unused. Instead, we stayed and Fanshawe went. And he entered to the mental home somewhere up the east coast of the United Kingdom to finish his days. The rest of us stayed in the Navy and ended up, as you know. We then were there till after Christmas, and then in January, the 10 of us went off to join HMS Vindictive, which was a seagoing cadet training ship.
Yes.
Two cruises, one to the West Indies, and one to the Baltic. The West Indies cruise, nothing I can recall, but the Baltic cruise was interfered with in the sense that half cadets came down with German measles en route from Helsinki to Copenhagen. And of course, we were looking forward to Copenhagen, having been told all about the attractive blonde girls, and we would moor alongside the main street, and everything was right ready for us, with girls in the, putting their heads in the portholes. Unfortunately, we never saw Copenhagen. We went to a more attractive Scottish port called Invergordon. And instead of blonde Danish girls, we saw white Scottish sheep. No more comment.
Not on sheep, no.
So we finished Vindictive, and then we split up as we graduated to the great rank of midshipman, and we went to our respective battleships and cruisers for our 2 years midshipman time. I went to the Mediterranean. I had asked for the Med, and I joined HMS Barham, Beery Barham, in September 38. Our captain was an interesting old joker. He had a high voice, he was short, and one day one can see the group of us standing on being called cleared lower decks all to the forecastle. And the captain said, "I understand whenever we play football, soccer, or rugger, the teams are cheered on by up the Beeries. I would like it to be known from now on that we are not Beeries. The Beery Barons. We played Warspite that afternoon, and of course from there on we were called the Milksops. Until later we got a new captain, Hookie Walker by name, who lost one hand at Zeebrugge in 1915-16, when it was. And he let it be known that he rather enjoyed the term, Beery Baron, and so we returned to that wonderful spirit. But there, in Grand Harbor, 1938, behind the battle wagon line was Sussex, and aboard HMS Sussex was one then Thomas Charles Pullen, midshipman, one Robert Murdoch, midshipman. They were 1 year at least ahead of me. So they were old midshipmen.
You're in Valletta, in Malta.
That's right.
Yeah.
And after a year in Barham, going through the various crises, the Munich crisis, where every time there was a crisis in Europe, the Mediterranean fleet would move to Alexandria, which was our war station. And another time, we went to, when the crisis was over, I can see us in Naples, here the battleship. The captain, Hooky Walker, was to call on the senior person in Naples, the Prince of Piedmont.
Spell it, please.
Prince of Piedmont, P-I-E-D-M-O-N-T.
Yeah.
And he was royal blood. The captain got correctly dressed in swords and medals. I was ordered to go along as his aide, as a midshipman, so I put on my dirk. And my bum freezer, the jacket we all had with lots of buttons. And
three buttons on the sleeve?
Three yeah. buttons on the sleeve and 12 on the breast. So we embarked in an Italian staff car, went up to the palace. We come inside the main entrance. We're met by a secretary into many gorgeous rooms. When finally out came the personal secretary of the prince, who insisted before we were to meet the prince, we had to take our swords off as they were considered weapons. And you know what amount of damage a dirk could do, apart from drawing blood on other midshipmen's bums in the shower rooms. So we left our swords and dirks, we went in to meet the Prince of Piedmont, and life went on. War broke out, 1939, and there was that little hesitation, as you remember, those of us who are Canadians, with the Royal Navy. There was a period of about 10 days when Canada was not at war with Germany. But in a good British spirit, that was quickly overlooked, because in those days, we did not have Canada flashes on our shoulders, though I admit we had Canada on our buttons. Mm-hmm. But it took a sharp eye and
yes.
a telescope to tell the difference. Barham sailed from the Mediterranean. And it's interesting how the cycle of life catches up with you. With Barham, we had six D-class destroyers that had been out in the Mediterranean. As we left Gibraltar, we were bound for the United Kingdom when the orders came through to divert and go to the Battle of the River Plate, as the Grasse Bay had been holed up and Admiralty diverted more forces in case the cruisers couldn't handle her. And as you know what happened, she came out and blew herself up, and we never got that. In fact, we didn't even get as far as the equator. When we altered course again for Halifax, where we joined the 1st Canadian Troop Convoy, TC-1, and escorted TC-1, as a fear then that there were a number of German battleships ready to run and intercept the 1st Canadian Troop, which was a large troop convoy and a valuable target. As we arrived in the Clyde, Scotland, a dark night, pitch black, no radar in those days.
No.
The destroyers were ahead of us, and we were leading the convoy into the Clyde. The last turn, as you come up, you were called to port. The signal went out by flashing light, the famous blue shaded light, and on our port bow was the HMS Duchess. Five destroyers and Barham altered to port, and the Duchess altered to starboard and went right across our bows. And Barham was fitted with a ram bow of 1914-15 design. We hit the Duchess, rolled her over. She swung up on her keel up and swung alongside. This was again 1:30 in the morning.
Keel?
Just to remember the time, 1:30 in the morning.
Keel up?
Yes. When I came on, I came off watch at midnight. We were sleeping in our hammocks, the midshipman's flat, under the quarterdeck. As we scrambled up the ladder, looking over the side on the starboard side, I saw my first ASDIC dome. Two destroyer propellers slowly turning, and a rudder. Suddenly the ship heaved by the bow, came up, and a number of portholes opened. And heads came out, human heads, popped their heads out, and of course called out to get them out. In those days our destroyers were not fitted with any escape hatches. There is no way you could get out of the straw hats. It was too small. You could get your head out, but you couldn't get your shoulders out. The other factor was, in those days, and it continued for a fair time into the war, all destroyers kept 10 depth charges on the rails and the throwers set to 50 feet.
Yes.
And this was for the emergency attack, as we called it in those days.
Yes.
So the captain of the Barham, again Hooky Walker, was very worried about if the stern of the Dutchess sank to 30 feet, which was sufficient then to detonate the charges.
Yes.
They charge it with countermine and then would sink the Barham.